Good afternoon. Welcome back to Wisconsin's Missing and Unsolved, and taking the time to hear some of Wisconsin's cold or forgotten cases. On this podcast, I dive into the stories and mysteries of Wisconsin's missing persons and unsolved crimes, whose stories deserve to be told and not forgotten. So many other notorious cases can take over media attention that leave others lost in the midst of it. And on top of that, there are a lot of older cases that just get left in the past. Over time, if no new leads or evidence come about, many cases just continue to get swept under the rug. Wisconsin has over 1,700 unsolved murders and over 140 missing persons. Realizing how many people are still waiting to be found or have their killers caught was the primary inspiration to start this podcast. By telling these stories, it keeps these people's names and stories out there. So the goal of this podcast is to raise awareness of those persons who have yet to finish telling us their stories. Today's case is dedicated to the story of Connie Belter. Connie was born on January 26, 1950, in Anago, Wisconsin, to parents Emmett and Helen Strube. Or Strube, I apologize if I pronounced that wrong. She had three brothers and two sisters. Later, she would have a son, Michael, and two daughters, Dawn and Lynn. And she had nine grandchildren. She worked at Wolf River Community Bank as a loan officer in Hortonville, Wisconsin. She loved spending time with her children and grandchildren, attending family functions, rummage sales, and sewing. She volunteered for the United Fund in Hortonville, Relay for Life, and Big Brothers Big Sisters. She also loved spending weekends with her mother in Anago. On the morning of Wednesday, November 15th, 2006, Connie's daughter got a call that her mother had not reported to work that day. When she went to her home to check on her, she found Connie deceased as the result of what looked like a brutal attack. Police were called to the scene, and it was clear that this was no accident, but an act of foul play, ruling her death as a homicide as a result of blunt force trauma to the head. There were no signs of a forced entry or struggle, indicating that Connie likely knew her killer and trusted them in her home. DNA was collected from the scene. For years, police struggled to find new evidence linking anyone to the crime and were left with little to no leads. However, James Olson has always been considered a person of interest. James Olson was her coworker and the founder and bank president of Wolf River Community Bank. However, there was never enough evidence to file charges. So why was he considered a suspect, and why couldn't they charge him? It was discovered that Olson was in severe debt and was violating bank practices and federal loan requirements. And in Connie's position as a loan processor, she would have had direct knowledge of any illegal or unethical activity occurring. She was the one responsible for entering loans into the general ledger, and it stated that she had discussed with another coworker that she had concerns and suspicions about unethical loan activity happening just days before her death. If James Olson was a part of illegal or unethical activity where Connie had an opportunity to expose him, he would have clear motive, knew where she lived, she would have trusted him in her home, thus giving him the perfect opportunity to commit this crime. Additionally, after a year from Connie's murder, he was insistent that they take down all of the reward posters posted around Wolf River Bank, saying that it was time to move on, to which other coworkers and Connie's children found very odd. Police carried out at least 21 search warrants, subpoenas, and court orders for both his home and the bank over the course of 3 to 4 years. The warrants allowed police to obtain information on his personal finances, bank records, phone records, clothing, tools, computers, journals, photographs, and his fingerprints for comparison to those discovered at the crime scene. They also tracked his car by GPS for 3 months in an attempt to get him to lead them to new evidence and or the murder weapon, to which they have never found to this day. All of which turned up with no connection to Connie's murder. Even with all of the accusations against him and the chaos of everything, he continued working at the bank and retired in 2014, and was also re-elected to a 3-year term on the bank's board of directors that March. He continues to profess his innocence and states that he would prefer his name to stay out of all papers and stories regarding the crime, as well as denying comments to the media. So far, police do say that he has been cooperative throughout the whole process. Later on, USA Today Network, Wisconsin, filed a public records request to obtain pages of the search warrants, subpoenas, and court documents, which date back to December of 2012. A lot of new information was found that was originally not released to the public. The lead investigator, Sergeant Daniel Tauber, claimed that this was a crime of passion, i.e., was not premeditated and came from a moment of rage. Additionally, a neighbor's statement claimed that a dark-colored Ford Taurus, or Mercury Sable, was parked outside her house on November 14th, the day before she was discovered. They also said that they'd seen the same vehicle there more than 30 times over the last 2 years. And at the time of this crime, Olson did own a 1996 Ford Taurus. A neighbor also said that they saw a man leave her home between 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. He was described as 50 to 60 years old, 6 to 6 and a half feet tall, wearing a flannel shirt and a hat with ear flaps. Crime scene photos show blood spatter on her skin, clothing, bedding, and wall, so it's likely that the killer also got blood on themselves as a result of spatter. Another witness claimed they saw Olson with blood spatter on the front of his sweatshirt and pants at an Oshkosh adult bookstore the following weekend. Would Olson really keep a shirt that would link him directly to a crime and then wear it in public? Olson's coworkers do say, however, that Olson was known to wear stained clothes on a regular basis, so perhaps it wasn't blood and may not be that odd at all. There were further interactions with Olson that raised suspicion among investigators. On July 19, 2012, Olson consented to a DNA sample, but then later said he felt that the procedure was inappropriate and that he'd lost sleep over it. Then a few months later, on September 7th, 2012, during a police interview, he referred to Connie's murder as an accident. It was public knowledge that Connie had been a victim of murder by blunt force trauma, likely a crime of passion. But could Olson be alluding to his involvement and that it was an unintentional attack, thus feeling as though it were an accident? An email from Olson to Connie was later discovered that was dated August 1st, 2006, about a loan request from Benchmark Development for $725,000. In the email, he noted that only one signature was needed to sign off on it. However, according to bank procedures, a loan of that size would need to be approved by the entire board of directors, not just Olson. This statement was from Harold Hermanson, who was the vice president of Wolf River Community Bank, who also said that Olson was the only mortgage originator who didn't comply with the Safe Mortgage Licensing Act of 2008. Which required him to submit his fingerprints for a criminal background check, which he refused to do. Refusing to submit to a background check and submit his fingerprints, he still continued processing mortgages in clear violation of the act. Looking into Olson's financial records, on November 13, 2006, just days before Connie's death, Olson and his wife had a $50,000 loan from Dairyman State Bank and listed that date, November 13th, as the day they bought their house, even though they had lived there for years. On the 30th of that month, he also bought a new car for $28,474. And they also had loans that same year from Associated Bank for $100,363 and from Premier Community Bank for $160,672. 6 years later, in 2012 and 2013, they took out more loans of $60,000 from Premier Community Bank, $174,000 from Wolf River Community Bank, and $225,000 from American Bank. It seems that James Olson was involved in some shady financial business, which Connie was starting to key in on, and had the perfect motive to want to keep his secrets hushed. What's interesting, however, in 2016, fresh forensic testing has excluded Olson as a suspect. At the scene of the crime, a DNA profile known as YSTR was found and compared to Olson, which was not a match. YSTR is a certain DNA profile where the Y represents the male Y chromosome, and STR stands for short tandem repeat. It is a genetic material carried only by men through the paternal line, though it's weaker in confirming DNA compared to autosomal STRs, though it can still be used for forensics in eliminating or including suspects. There were at least two profiles found at the scene, and neither matched to anyone known to have been in Connie's home. So even though they have these DNA profiles, forensics would still need a full profile to fully confirm a person's involvement. So was James Olson really involved, then, if his DNA was not at the scene? Certainly, he has motive, but there's nothing to show that he was there. Could he have hired someone? Have we been looking at the wrong person this entire time? The new lead investigator, Neil Rabas, who took over after Sergeant Daniel Tauber retired, says that they refuse to eliminate anyone as a suspect and will continue to consider Olson a suspect if new information comes forward linking him to the crime. Besides Olson, no other suspects or solid leads have come up in Connie's case. Today, James Olson has since moved to Alaska. Connie's case was featured on America's Most Wanted in May of 2010. Later in 2010, the family hosted Connie's Ride, which was held on June 12th of that year in remembrance of Connie. They had a group of motorcyclists and caravans going around to several bars throughout Hortonville and Kaukauna. Their ride ended at Bean City Bar and Grill, where they hosted a meal, a 50-50 raffle, basket raffles, and had a band playing. All of the proceeds collected were to continue supporting Connie's billboard campaign. There is a $10,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible for Connie's murder. If you know something that could help bring Connie's killer to justice, please contact the Appleton Police Department at 1-920-832-5500. You may also leave anonymous tips through the department's website or email apdtips@appleton.org. These details will be listed in the show notes. You can also visit conniebelter.com for more information. Thank you for listening and taking the time to hear Connie's story today. Please take this podcast and either share it or talk about it with friends and family. The more people who know, the greater awareness given to the case. Again, thank you for listening to today's episode of Wisconsin's Missing and Unsolved. Please subscribe and keep an eye out for next week's episode. You can also follow these cases on Instagram at Wisconsin's Missing Unsolved, where I'll be posting images of the victims and other images related to the case. Also, please go subscribe to my Patreon under Wisconsin's Missing and Unsolved. You can become a member and get early access to episodes, hear my thoughts on what I think may have happened and who's responsible, and help decide which cases to cover next. If you have a case that you want featured on this podcast sooner rather than later, please email wisconsinsmissingunsolved@gmail.com. All details will be listed in the show notes. Thank you, and see you next week.